Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ricky Solinger, historian and author, who talks about President Bush's executive order that bars federal funding to family planning programs that offer abortion services and counseling overseas and its implications for women worldwide. Max Sawicki, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, who assesses the Bush administration's $1.6 trillion tax cut proposal as the plan gained momentum on Capitol Hill. And author and energy activist Harvey Wasserman, who takes a critical look at California's utility deregulation disaster and the remedies offered to repair the damage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Extra, the magazine published by the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, finds that the American media has chosen sides and is presenting a distorted view of the new Palestinian uprising in the Middle East. Extra claims major U.S. press outlets have blacked out the basic political underpinning of the running street battles between Palestinian youths and Israeli security forces. Since the collapse of peace talks last summer, 90% of all American TV network reports on the uprising failed to label the West Bank and Gaza occupied territories, or note the United Nations resolutions objecting to Israeli control of these lands. In contrast, during the Intifada of the early 1990s, the term occupied territories was used in three-quarters of all network reports. Extra provides the example of Time magazine's publication of a cover story titled Terror in the Middle East, linking the attack of the USS Cole to the sentiment behind a mob on the West Bank that killed two Israeli soldiers. Left out of the story was any mention of the 120 Palestinians who by mid-October were killed by Israeli forces. Ironically, readers in Israel get a more balanced view of the decades-long political conflict. Amika Hess, a correspondent for Haaretz, one of Israel's leading newspapers, wrote in a commentary in a French newspaper that the Oslo peace process had failed. She wrote that Oslo had left the Palestinian territories in so many fragmented cages, reinforcing the settlements and tying future economic development to Palestinian acceptance of a new form of Israeli control. The Nation magazine reports that Florida Governor Jeb Bush oversaw a massive voter purge operation prior to last November's election that prevented thousands of African Americans from voting. For 2 years, Bush led an effort to scrub convicted felons from the county voter rolls. Further, Bush and state officials went so far as to take away voting rights from people convicted of felonies in other states, which, unlike Florida, restores voting rights after an inmate is released from prison. David Bosaitis of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies calls the voter purge program a patently obvious technique to discriminate against black voters. Pastor Thomas Johnson, who runs the House of Hope, a ministry for ex-convicts in Gainesville, Florida, became a victim of the purge of voter lists when he attempted to register. Johnson's application was rejected because he had served time in New York for selling crack in the late 1980s before becoming a minister. To register to vote, Reverend Johnson was told he needed to seek clemency from the governor's office, but he refused to fill out the 15-page clemency application. Later, Pastor Johnson told The Nation magazine, "How can I ask the governor for rights that I already have?" The news magazine In These Times reports the Chicago Police Department is trying to resurrect its Red Squad. The department, formerly called the Subversive Activities Unit, kept files on 250,000 political activists and legal organizations in the 1960s and 70s. The Red Squad was terminated in 1981 by a court-ordered consent decree. Yet in 1997, the city of Chicago tried to get back in the business of political snooping by amending the court order. The district court rejected that request, but the city is now appealing. Civil liberties advocates charge that the Chicago Police Department is already involved in political surveillance. They point to the police raid and macing of activists in the 1996 active resistance counter-demonstration at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. In court papers, civil liberties lawyers are asking that tougher restrictions be placed on the Chicago Police Department. Vic Speedwell, a counter-convention organizer, claims that over 100 police officers stormed the alternative convention. Speedwell told In These Times that the cops walked in through the back room and told everyone not to move. They covered up and removed their badges, then they maced people. Scrutiny of Chicago's Red Squad comes as police departments in other cities, such as Seattle, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Philadelphia, stand accused of violating the First Amendment rights of activists in the growing global social justice movement. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
First on his agenda, 2 days after taking office and on the 28th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, President George W. Bush sent a loud and clear message to the world's women. He directed the administrator of the United States Agency for International Development to, quote, reinstate in full all of the requirements of the Mexico City policy, which bars federal funding to family planning programs that offer abortion services and counseling overseas. This is deja vu for those who first saw it imposed during the Reagan administration. President Clinton had restored the funding 2 days after taking office in 1993. Critics charge Bush's reinstatement of the order will not reduce the level of legal or illegal abortions, but will deny women access to contraceptives, which will increase unintended pregnancies. Under this so-called Mexico City policy, many clinics feared losing U.S. government funding if they treated women suffering from botched illegal abortions, even if it was technically permitted. Instituting a global gag rule will force many clinics to make a choice whether to accept American government funding and the restrictions on providing safe and legal abortion services and counseling women on the abortion option, or refuse the funds and curtail health services due to the decreased assistance. Bush stated that part of his intention was to ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used to fund abortions overseas. However, using federal funds for abortion services internationally has been banned since 1973 under the Helms Amendment. Ricky Solinger is a historian of reproduction and welfare politics in the U.S. She spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about the Bush policy.
When President Bush looks across the ocean and decides that it's a bad idea for the United States to fund women's access to reproductive services and information, he's saying, in effect, that he doesn't think that women abroad should be full citizens. What we know is that when the United States withdraws its funding, the impact is swift and the impact is cruel, that there will be a very much higher rate, millions, in fact, more unintended pregnancies, and many more abortions, legal and illegal, because people are lacking information about contraception and contraceptive devices. It's very, very important that people who know about the past, who know how difficult it was for women to be full citizens when they couldn't control their own bodies, who know that in the past, it wasn't so much a matter of the so-called back alley butcher who endangered women. This is an icon that I, as a historian, reject, but I understand very, very clearly that women were endangered, desperately endangered, before Roe v. Wade, because in their desperation they so often tried to self-abort. They so often had to have pregnancies and children who they couldn't afford to have, or who they were forced to give up because they were unmarried, or all kinds of terrible things that degraded women. I think that we always stand to lose ground, but I also think that there's a healthy, critical mass of Americans who understand the crucial importance of women being able to control their own bodies, and I think it's a matter of re-energizing and reminding and insisting that people who believe in the crucialness of this right to become activists once again.
It is, to the best of my knowledge, that since 1973, right after Roe v. Wade, the option to use federal funds for abortions overseas was outlawed. There was a law passed that overseas clinics could not use federal funds.
In the immediate period following Roe, poor women in the United States who were unwillingly pregnant and decided to seek abortions, those women could get federally funded abortions. That it was not until the late 1970s, 1977, when the Hyde Amendment outlawed federal funding for abortions, did 4 years later federal money become unavailable for the abortions of poor women. Roe v. Wade did not create abortion as a right for all women. It created it as a choice for only those women who had the money to pay for it.
Coming from Texas, where 37 executions were carried out in the year 2000, it indicates to me that a life inside the womb is much more valuable than one outside the womb. And I realize that these are, for the most part, some capital crimes that have been committed. But if a life is so precious to George W. Bush, it would appear that at least supporting a lifetime without parole of imprisonment would be a better choice than execution. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, you know, the reproductive rights movement has had for many years a, and maybe since the Reagan administration or even before when this Hyde Amendment was promulgated in the late 70s, that this motto, really, this taunt against people who don't want women, poor women particularly, to have reproductive rights, that life begins at conception and ends at birth, you know, that the religious right and the conservative right is so concerned about the unborn child but so unconcerned about the born child, and in terms of the kinds of funding that are that's available for education and for daycare, for health care, for young children in this country. And I think you're point is very well taken, that I myself have never been able to understand how people with the politics of George Bush, people with the professed religiously founded principles of George Bush can claim that it's not a paradox to be in favor of capital punishment and against abortion. These positions simply don't make sense to me. But when public policies are based on principles of racial bias, class bias, when social policies are not founded in concepts of justice and equal rights and human rights, these paradoxes will always be present.
That was Ricky Solinger, historian and author. Her new book, available this summer, is titled Beggars and Choosers: How the Politics of Choice Shapes Abortion, Adoption, and Welfare in the United States, published by Hill and Wang. George W. Bush campaigned on the promise that if elected, he would work to pass a $1.6 trillion tax cut. The tax cut, if enacted, would in fact be the largest since the Reagan administration's often criticized supply-side economic policies of the 1980s. During the election campaign, Vice President Gore warned that the Bush tax cut would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest sector of society and threaten economic stability, an argument that initially dampened public enthusiasm for the proposal. But since the election dispute ended with the Supreme Court's controversial decision to stop counting votes, handing the White House to Bush, and a downturn in the U.S. economy, the Republican tax plan has gained new momentum. In recent testimony before the Senate Budget Committee, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan reversed his previous position opposing large-scale tax cuts. Some Democrats have now also signed onto the Bush plan, including Georgia Senator Zell Miller, who says he'll co-sponsor the GOP's tax legislation. Meanwhile, business lobbyists and their allies in Congress are reported to be advocating billions of additional tax cuts for corporate America. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Max Zawicki, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, who assesses the Bush tax plan and progressive alternatives that he asserts could more fairly strengthen a lagging economy.
One of the deceptive things about it is that because it's phased in, the full cost of the plan is not obvious from the price tag. The plan is phased in over a 10-year period. Since some of the provisions don't take effect till later in the decade, the overall cost of it is not really reflected in the 10-year cost. The total cost of it is probably going to be over $2 trillion. The biggest pieces of it are a repeal of the estate and gift tax and a cut in marginal income tax rates, a so-called across-the-board cut, which means that each rate is cut in equal percentage terms. People are under the illusion that this means everybody gets the same cut in percentage terms, but that's actually not accurate, unfortunately. There's also some other things in there. There's an effort to reduce marriage penalties. There's a new bottom tax rate. They take the bottom bracket, the 15% bracket, and they cut it into two pieces, and they make basically a new 10% bracket in there. So those are the big pieces.
Assess for us, if you would, the primary beneficiaries of this tax plan as now proposed.
Well, it's upper income people. The vast bulk of the benefits in this plan, and there's very little disagreement about this, go to people with incomes above the median level, and by median I mean something between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. The benefits are very much concentrated among the top 1 or 2% of taxpayers, as a point that Al Gore tried to make during the campaign, but apparently not quite well enough. From the standpoint of stimulating the economy, it makes much more sense to cut taxes for people that are likely to spend the money rather than people that are likely to take the tax cut and buy financial assets with it.
The tax cut has been the holy grail of supply-side economic advocates, you know, since, I guess, well before the Reagan administration. What's your opinion of tax cuts as a way to sort of bolster the economy as it hits what many are predicting to be a recession on the horizon?
It's very dubious. I think ultimately that the tax cut's capacity to do something right now to avert some recession or slowdown is certainly limited. The real person who should be on the spot in terms of acting right now is Alan Greenspan in the Federal Reserve, and unfortunately, they've been getting a free pass from politicians in both parties for some time now.
Well, tell us about Alan Greenspan and the comments he made before the Senate Budget Committee, which were interpreted by many Republicans and many political pundits that he gave the green light for the Bush people to go ahead with this tax cut. What's your take on what he said?
I think he did in the following sense. Greenspan really comes off as a political hack in terms of his testimony. It was inconsistent, illogical, and contradicted his previous position. The key in terms of the Bush program is that Greenspan really gave support to the most politically difficult and one of the biggest pieces of the Bush proposal, namely to cut marginal tax rates. That was the piece of the program that would have the most difficulty politically, and Greenspan, undoubtedly knowing exactly what effect his words would have, sort of offered in a casual way, well, I've always been for cutting marginal tax rates. So, in effect, he really did give a boost to Bush, and the wonder is that nobody called him on it, and instead the members of Congress sat there with their mouths hanging open trying to figure out what was going on. What was going on was just a blatant political play by Greenspan in concert with Bush. For 8 years, Greenspan was yammering about the need for fiscal discipline when it looked like a Democratic president might have gotten some credit for doing something in the vein of large tax cuts or large spending increases. Now that we don't have a Democratic president anymore, apparently it's going to be let the good times roll as far as this surplus, even though there's really nothing to justify this change of position on Greenspan's part.
In terms of educating the public on the deceptions and illusions in this tax plan, you don't think we can depend too much on the Democrats for that, I assume?
I think the main problem they have is not their ability to explain any of this. I think they've been trying to do that. The main problem on their side is the reluctance to coalesce around something big and progressive in opposition. In other words, to have an alternative. I don't think you can beat something with nothing. And I don't think you can beat the Bush package with six nice little things. I think you need something big. It doesn't have to be as big as Bush's plan, but it has to be big enough to be very noticeable and to grab people's attention. And if people are able to look at that closely enough, they'll see that most of them will benefit more from something progressive than whatever Bush comes out with.
That was Max Sawicki, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Contact the Institute by calling them at area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at www.epinet.org. For months now, the state of California has been reeling from the disastrous effects of electric utility deregulation. With blackouts, brownouts, and the threat of bankruptcy for the state's largest electric companies, the crisis has taken on importance beyond California's borders, threatening, some say, the floundering national economy. The Bush administration is taking full advantage of the crisis to promote its policy of expanding energy exploration and the weakening of environmental standards. But consumer advocates say the crisis is not the result of an energy shortage so much as the unbridled greed of the utilities themselves, who pushed through deregulation legislation in 1996. They point out that a 1998 referendum, sponsored by consumer and environmental groups that would have repealed deregulation and averted the crisis, was defeated by a $40 million campaign waged by the utilities. In a scheme backed by California's Democratic Governor Gray Davis, the state will invest billions to save the utilities from bankruptcy in exchange for stock options, a solution that is criticized by many as a conflict of interest for state regulators who control electric rates. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with energy activist Harvey Wasserman, author of The Last Energy War, The Battle Over Utility Deregulation, who takes a critical look at California's electric power disaster and the various remedies offered to repair the damage.
The utility deregulation bill, AB 1890, which was passed unanimously by the California legislature in 1996, was written in the offices of Southern California Edison. They set this whole thing up. And the reason they set it up was so that they could rip off from the ratepayers and the taxpayers up to $28.5 billion in so-called stranded cost rebates. That's their euphemism for taking money out of the public pocket to pay for their bad investments, most importantly their nuclear plant. The line was the same. They said basically, well, we'll have competition, and down the road, because of competition, your electric rates will go down, but in the meantime, you have to pay us off for all these ridiculous nuclear and bad coal burners and all these other plants that we built that are unprofitable. And so in California, the utilities walked away with more than $20 billion. And what they did was they shuttled that money out of the actual distribution companies and to the parent companies. And so these distribution companies, Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison, which are claiming that they're about to go bankrupt, actually shuffled, you know, they brown bagged $20 billion, all in small bills, to their parent companies. And now the parent companies are refusing to account for that money. And the distribution companies are claiming they're about to go bankrupt. You know, this is something that would make Al Capone quite proud. What the other thing that happened was the utilities that wrote this bill made a miscalculation. They agreed to freeze rates to the consumers, which is, you know, only vaguely fair because they're stealing so much money for the stranded costs. And in exchange for that, they forgot to freeze the rates from the wholesale suppliers. Now, they figured that they'd have enough supply to deal with this, but they were forced to, basically, the bill asked them to divest from their themselves of their generating plants. And in most cases, they just shuffled the generating plants to the parent companies. And in fact, all the money that the distribution companies are losing is being made, or much of it is being made by the parent companies. So where PG&E and Southern California Edison, the distribution companies, are getting socked and losing a fortune, PG&E and Mission Energy, the parent companies, are making a fortune selling the electricity to their distribution companies. It's unbelievable that they're getting away with this. Now, some of the facilities that they sold, the generators, they did sell to companies like Enron, which is the biggest natural gas distributor in the country, and also George Bush's biggest single financial contributor, and another Texas company called Reliant. There's one called Dynergy. There's Duke Power from North Carolina. These companies went in and bought up generating facilities, and they're making out like bandits. They're manipulating the grid. They're playing games with the supply and demand curve, and they're making billions of dollars with the pretense that there's not enough electricity, which is nonsense. There's plenty of electricity. They're just making a fortune. And now they're using it as an excuse to bust the Clean Air Act and lift environmental restrictions on these polluting coal and gas and oil burners. And they're even talking about building new nuclear plants, although that one ain't going to happen. So it's an astounding scam. Totally amazing.
Just a question about the proposed solution from, as you described them, the new Democrat, Governor Gray Davis of California. From what I understand, they're going to exchange a state bailout in California of the major utilities there for stock options. And some people have raised questions about a conflict of interest for the state of California in being a stockholder in these major utility companies at the same time these state regulatory boards have to determine rates for consumers. But beyond that, what's your view of the plan to make things right in California as it sits now?
It's ridiculous. I mean, they're giving them hundreds of million dollars. They should be buying assets, buying power plants, buying infrastructure, and turning it over to the municipalities. There's only one form of electric power control that works, and that's public power and primarily municipal power. California is obviously too big to have a single state-run utility. What you need to do, and what Gray Davis isn't doing, the governor of California, typical spineless new Democrat, took $600,000 in contributions from the utility companies. They're using all this state money to bail out the utilities to make sure they don't go bankrupt and all this stuff, and they should go bankrupt. And what should happen is that the state should be buying assets with the bailout money, and they should turn those assets around and have a statewide network of municipal-owned utilities. There's two utilities in California that have thrived in this crisis, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and they're both municipal-owned. They have a much higher percentage of renewables. They do efficiency, and they're actually their rates have not gone up, and they've actually made money exporting power to the rest of the grid. So what we hope will happen in California is this crisis will spawn a whole movement. I know that it looks like it's going to be on the ballot in San Francisco for municipals to get together and to take over their utility companies.
That was Harvey Wasserman, author of The Last Energy War, The Battle Over Utility Deregulation, published by Seven Stories Press. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Harry Minot, Archibald Curry, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.